Okay, we'll get right bound, back to the program, down to business. There's going to be two talks, as you know, on phase plates, each about a half hour long. And the first one is Rado Donev, who is now at the Max Planck Institute in Martin Street. We'll be talking about phase plates for single particle.
Thanks, Bob, and thanks to Bridget and Clint for inviting me and giving me the difficult task of speaking about single particles and phase plates. This meeting is about sharing experiences and problems and issues, so I hope my talk won't disappoint in that respect. So maybe many of you have heard about phase plates already. The phase plate is a device which we position usually at the back focal plane of the objective lens, and its function is to change the phase of the scattered waves so that we get phase contrast in the image, in-focus phase contrast, similarly to what we have in light microscopy. The simplest and the oldest type of phase plate used in TM is the so-called Zernike phase plate, where we have a thin film with a small hole in the center, and when it's positioned at the back focal plane, we place the central diffraction beam inside the hole so it doesn't experience any phase shift, and all the scattered or most of the scattered electrons pass through the film and experience half-pi phase shift. Now, more recently, our lab, in collaboration with FEI, we developed a different type of phase plate, which we found to be more practical and user-friendly, and we call it the Volta phase plate. The small but significant difference between the Zernike and the Volta is that the Volta has no hole. So we just have a continuous carbon film, exactly the same as with the Zernike phase plate, but instead of a hole which creates the phase shift difference, there is something happening where the beam hits the film. Now, big advantage of having no hole means we have no jump in the Fourier space where the edge of the hole is, so we have a kind of a continuous phase contrast transfer, so this avoids some of the fringing artifacts. This is what happens when we position the film and start imaging continuously with this type of phase plate. You see with each consecutive image, the contrast of the image increases, and also the CTF changes so that the CTF rings move inwards. Now, this is significant. The fact that they move inwards when we are under focus, that shows us that what we are observing is not actually due to electrostatic charging or contamination on the film. And now that's the difficult thing to explain with this phase plate, is we actually don't have a perfect idea or experimental evidence about what exactly is happening to create the phase shift. We only have some hypotheses. And this is also why we call it the Volta phase plate. We suppose that it's a change probably in the surface chemistry of the film at the position of the central beam, where adsorbed or chemisorbed species on the surface of the film get desorbed under the radiation, and then this creates a different work function in this place. Now, there is some literature evidence that, for example, oxidation or other chemical modifications of carbon surface can increase the work function, and that's consistent with what we are observing. So if there is oxidation on the surface and these atoms are removed and we have only dangling bonds, then we can get what we are observing. Now, this is a simple simulation. If we have a grounded conductor in vacuum and then we have a potential, constant potential patch on the surface, then we get a 3D distribution of the electrostatic potential above the surface. And if we integrate this potential along Z, so, you know, the electrons which travel along Z, they will experience the integrated potential, we get such a profile. So we see that it's quite well constrained within the roughly the... Maybe that's my phone. I should put it further away. Okay. Quite close to the... well constrained within the limits of this patch, so we don't have a lot of phase shift spill outside, and that's a nice thing that we can actually get a very nice and limited effect. This is an example, a better example of what happens when we start exposing on the area of the phase plate. So you see the fringes of the CTF move inwards, and that actually shows us that the phase shift gradually increases with the dose. This is a plot of the phase shift versus the total dose accumulated on the film. And what's nice about this phase plate is that the phase shift doesn't depend on dose rate, but on the total dose. So we can kind of predict or plan the phase shift we want to have by just irradiating the film with a particular dose. So here you see for three different beam currents, we just irradiated and measured the phase shift, and of course the curves have different lengths because the total dose is just integration of the beam times the time, the beam current times the time. So anyway, this is a nice thing to have. So we don't have to worry about the dose rate. Now another interesting thing is that the phase shifting spots or patches which we create on the film, they fade with time. So here you see carbon film which has a fibbed hole in it, so it's like a Zernike faceplate hole, just as a reference, and here we have created such a patch on the film. Now after 3 days, the first patch has disappeared, and now we can create a new one. So that means that if we have one film or one faceplate in the microscope, we can use one area for one experiment, then move to a new area and do this a few times, and then after a few days or a week, we can actually go back to the original area and reuse it again. So we don't have to exchange the faceplate that often as a Zernike faceplate, for example. Now, what's interesting about these patches is if we investigate in more detail their recovery, we see that surprisingly there is actually no dependence on the temperature of the film, but there is a strong dependence on the use or not of the anti-contamination device. So this is the indication, the only indication actually we have that it's probably related to the surface chemistry of the film. In terms of new hardware, this is what you get. It's a special objective lens aperture holder, you can call it. It has two positions for objective lens apertures and one position in the front here for the faceplate. You see this is kind of, it has these standoffs from the rest of the tip because there is an embedded heater under the faceplate which maintains it about 200, 250 degrees C to prevent contamination and to actually enable this Volta faceplate mode. In terms of software, FER is now working on developing new panels in their 10 user interface for the faceplate. So we have this part of the apertures control panel, we have the faceplate page, and here one can just switch. So once the faceplates are properly enumerated, so to say, you can just click next, 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 and it will automatically move to a new place on the film. So you don't have to manually search for a new position and so on. In terms of alignments, they have also these step-by-step procedures for aligning the pivot points and the on-plane condition, which I will talk in a bit. I'm still myself not happy, completely happy yet with these things because I can do it more accurately manually, but hopefully this will be improved in the future. In terms of lifetime, the Volta faceplate has a very long life. So typically the Zernike faceplates used in the past, which also I will talk about, they last maybe about a week after they have been put into the microscope, and then they have to be changed. Actually, the Volta faceplate is exploiting the effect which makes the Zernike faceplate age. So once it's aged, so to say, there is no more further change in the properties. So this is a bit, not very straight line, but you can see here that for about 6 months, the saturation phase shift of this faceplate in the F20 did not change much. So we used different conditions for the testing in the beginning, then we changed to different conditions. So this is kind of dose adjusted these, the red points, but anyway, there is not big change in the performance. This is in the Titan Krios. Again, we see quite a constant performance. So the lifetime is quite good. In terms of CTF performance, it looks really nice when one is careful to do the experiment properly, of course. So this is FFT of image of a carbon film without a faceplate, and here you see the faceplate. So we see a very nice complementary match between the maxima and minima in the two CTFs. And if we do the rotation averages and the CTF fittings, we see that we get a very, very nice performance in terms of no charging or deformations of the CTF. Now, there are also black lines which are overlapped on both of the red and the blue curves, which are the fits, but they are quite good, so you can see them only in few places. Now, the difference in defocus between the two after the fits is only 5 nanometer, and the defocus in this case is 500 nanometers, so the faceplate in this case is performing very, very well. Now, one issue which is still open with the Volta faceplate is the signal loss. Even though the film is thinner than the Zernike faceplate, we get about 18% signal loss. And we, at the moment, cannot explain the reason for this loss because the expected total scattering and loss is about 12% for this kind of thickness. One possibility is that there could be some fluctuations of the phase shift where the beam is hitting the film, or other effects which are introducing some kind of noise on the phase shift. Compared to the Zernike faceplate, one big advantage is, at least at first glance, is that we get no fringes. So here you see an image of wholly of lazy carbon with the Zernike faceplate. You see those fringes around the carbon edges and also around the film. This is an image with the water faceplate, so we get only smooth hollows around such edges. It's possible to software demodulate or kind of try to improve the Zernike faceplate image. It works somewhat, but there are still remaining artifacts, fringing artifacts in the software demodulated image. This is another semi-cryo example, so the specimen was a bit sublimated in this case. Unfortunately, I don't have many comparisons because once we started using the water faceplate, we just stopped producing Zernike faceplate. So I had kind of a Zernike faceplate, which I also used in water mode in the beginning for a short time, and after this, we didn't have that anymore. So in any ways, you also see here the fringes around the partially sublimated specimen parts, and here with the water faceplate, it looks much nicer and smoother. Just a comparison between the two. The water faceplate has a longer life. Now, the less information loss is a questionable thing at the moment, and we also don't know why we see the higher than expected information loss. No fringes, that's kind of a big thing, especially for tomography. It's much more user-friendly because you don't have to manually center a hole and maintain it on the beam, and it's also easy to automate for the same reason. In practice, what's important when you use the water faceplate, there are two important alignment things for the microscope. So one is the beam shift pivot points. The other one is to the so-called on-plane condition. What the on-plane condition also means is parallel illumination on the specimen you will see in the illustration later. For tomography, it's also beneficial to have a small amount of under focus with the faceplate. I also show the reason for that. And heating. Heating is essential for maintaining the contamination-free and the volta mode of the faceplate. Okay, next. So why the beam shift pivot points are so important? Well, in low-dose modes of operation, as you all know, we have the central, the optical axis, the coma-free axis, for example, where we do our exposures, and we use an off-axis place for focusing, tracking, or other such tasks. Now, when we do the imaging in the off-axis mode, we want to make sure that the beam at the back focal plane hits the faceplate at the same position as when we're on-axis. And that's this alignment is what the beam shift pivot points is actually the beam shift pivot point alignment. So if they are aligned properly in off-axis mode, our beam will hit the same spot on the faceplate. If there is even a slight misalignment, so this is a very sensitive alignment, because the beam spot at the faceplate is, beam crossover is like around 25 nanometers or so. So actually the phase shifting patch is bigger than that, but still it's a very sensitive alignment. So one has to be very careful with this alignment. So if the beam hits the faceplate on another spot nearby, what you see then in your images is that you get two spots on the faceplate, and then in the FFT you will see these parasitic spots near the center of the FFT, and also in the image you can see kind of a shadowing effect or such thing. So this should be avoided. The other alignment is the on-plane alignment. Now for F20 or other such microscopes with two condenser lenses, that kind of restricts your setting of your second condenser lens. But as already, I think Ivan mentioned, it's important also to have parallel illumination on the specimen. And actually, when you have the beam crossover on the faceplate, that also means by design, of the microscope that you have parallel illumination on your specimen. So by doing this adjustment for the faceplate, you also make sure that you have parallel illumination on your specimen. Now for the Krios, because it has three condenser lenses, you have quite a wide range in which you can change your beam size and still be close to parallel. Now for the faceplate, you still have to do fine-tuning because it's never perfectly parallel, and you have to fine-tune this before observations. That's quite easy, and people usually need very short introduction or demonstration how to do it. Now, why we want to be on plane? Because we want to have a very small phase shifting patch, and that's important because If we have a big patch, we are generating too much phase shift. It's just that a bigger patch will create a bigger 3D potential above the film, and then we get more phase shift. And we want to avoid phase shifts which are above half pi. They are not. They are already deteriorating the performance of the phase plate. Another reason is that with the smaller beam crossover, we get a lower cut-on frequency. So to say, that means the frequency at which our phase contrast CTF begins in Fourier space. So you see here, when we are on plane and when we have 1 micron beam spot on the phase plate, we get a bit lower performance for the very low frequencies. The heating, here you see an example again, the same animation you saw before, with the phase plate heated to 220 degrees C. You see the CTF rings are moving inwards. This means we are in the Volta mode. Now, if we reduce the temperature to around 60 degrees, we see the opposite. We see a kind of a strange ring which appears in the beginning close to the center, and then it starts to grow, and the CTF rings are moving outward. So this is consistent with contamination and positive charging in the center of the faceplate. So this is undesirable and cannot be used as a good faceplate. For tomography, why do we want to have a small amount of defocus? Because one reason is we want to avoid overfocusing, because then the CTF will cross the zero very close to the center. The other reason is that the Volta faceplate has not a constant phase shift, as you saw from the graph before. And that could mean that, for example, we are not yet at half pi and we have our CTF not starting at the maximum, but at some lower position. And if we are working just focus, then you will get kind of a flat transfer from that point on. So you have less than optimal information transfer for the higher frequencies. Of course, here the axis is in much lower, this is inverse nanometers. So this is in kind of a tomography range of resolution. So we apply a small defocus to make sure that our CTF has a maximum close or you know, a little bit below Nyquist frequency, so that we are getting optimal transfer for the higher frequencies. Now, in ideal case, for single particles, the faceplate will be used like that. So we automatically collect our images in focus with the faceplate. We easily pick the particles because of the very good and high contrast. We don't have to do any CTF fitting or correction. Then we reconstruct the data and get Triangstrom resolution with 10,000 asymmetric units. Then we press the publish button and order a Mai Tai on Waikiki Beach. But, well, in ideal world, actually, we should be able to do everything from the beach. I mean, it's automated and remote operation and so on. Now, in the real world, things are much more cloudy. So it works well with, now the good news first. So it works well with the FEI EPU software, so we can set it up and run it, and it will collect a lot of huge data amounts and lots of junk, as already Shore said. The initial setup is quite easy, so we have to make sure that the faceplate is inserted, and of course, after insertion, there is like 5 or 10 minutes of thermal drift in the beginning, which we have to wait, and then check the on-plane condition. After this, we can just run EPU. Now, at the current state of EPU, it has no faceplate option, so I will show you later. The phase shift gradually increases with time, so because the beam is hitting the same spot many times, and then it's necessary to actually change or move the faceplate to a new place every 100 or 200 exposures. This currently FEI is working on putting special options in EPU so that it can be automatically done. Another issue is the focusing, and this is probably the biggest issue with the faceplate at the moment. So precise focusing is currently not possible, at least not to the precision which would be necessary for intermediate resolutions. So to get some kind of intermediate resolution, we have to do CTF fitting and correction. This is the first data set I collected, of course, GRO-EL. And I collected it manually on the F20. It was 550 micrographs, 3,000 particles, and it went to about 8.3 angstrom resolution. Then we set on to a more challenging specimens, which, you know, the faceplate is supposed to provide advantage for smaller or less symmetric particles. So one good candidate was beta-galactosidase, because it could be just purchased from Sigma. If you are lucky, then you get a sample which looks like this. And our first grid actually was quite decent. After this, we had lots and lots of troubles of aggregated bunches of particles which are not usable. Unfortunately, the first data set only went to about 12 angstrom. So, and this is with CTF correction. We want to continue working on it, but my student is still trying to monomerize it, so to say. Then I also got another very nice test specimen from Mata and Voss. It actually came originally from James Conway. It's a D3 virus capsid. It's an acoustohedral virus, so it should be very easy, and theoretically it would show the optimal or the best possible resolution with the faceplate. Now, guess what? It also went to 8 angstrom. This is with the automatic data collection on the F20 and EPU. Now, then I said, okay, let me collect, this is with CTF correction, so without the correction, we get about 14 angstrom. So there is definitely some effect of the CTF correction. Then I sat on the Titan with the K2, and I manually collected 140 images, 900 particles, the whole symmetry, and again it went to 8 angstrom. So there is some curse, the 8 angstrom curse. Now, I'm not sure exactly what is happening. My hope is just the focusing accuracy, although the manual data collection should be kind of less sensitive to that because I was careful to focus properly. Anyway, we have to work more on that. Now, what's the issue with the focusing accuracy? Now, if you want to get, for example, 7 angstrom resolution, then with the faceplate, you have to be within the window of plus 40 minus 70 nanometer defocus. That means about 100 nanometer window in which your defocus must fall in. Now, with automatic data acquisition at the moment, that's quite impossible, at least not with the procedures which are put there. They were not made for accurate focusing, they were made for speed, because in conventional acquisitions, some defocus actually spread is beneficial. If we want to go to higher resolutions, then this one shrinks very quickly. So you have to be very, very accurate with your focusing. So what are the possible solutions? What are the approaches? Now, the ideal approach, as I already said, is the best thing would be if we can focus perfectly and then collect everything in focus. And that would be the best, actually, benefit from the faceplate because you get both no CTF zeros and the high contrast. In practice, one can do kind of a hybrid approach. So you collect focus pairs where one image, the one which will be used for reconstruction, is close to focus, and a second image which will be used for CTF fitting and defocus measurement is collected with some known amount of defocus, so that you can measure the defocus on this image and then correct, if necessary, this image. Or very much like conventional approach, so we collect everything defocused, and then we have to do the CTF fitting and reconstruction. This is what the ideal approach would look like. Of course, after seeing Holger's presentation this morning, I think there should be only one image in the center here instead of this very bad image shift and comma off axis, although we are quite far from comma issues yet. So ideally, one should be able to focus somewhere nearby and then collect images in the eyes, hoping that there is not much specimen tilt and additional defocus due to that. Maybe collect two focusing or do two focusings here and here so that you kind of do linear interpolation in between and acquire the images with a known defocus. What we have done so far and the data you saw for the D3, for example, was we do the EPU focusing here, then we collect 4 images with EPU. So these two are collected close to focus and these two on the carbon on both sides are collected afterwards with about 1 micron defocus. So I use these to fit the CTF and then linearly interpolate between them and then demodulate the CTFs of these two images. Yet another approach which are actually now we are now trying is using a thin carbon support, so like 3 nanometer carbon, to just focus here and then collect images and focusing images here on the thin carbon so that we are much closer to the actual places where you collected the images. This is what the CTF looks like from one of those data sets, and there are some red rings here which are probably not visible for you, but the CTF fit with the faceplate requires 4 parameters at least. That means defocus, phase shift, and 2 parameters for the astigmatism. So it's at least one more parameter than the conventional, depending on if you do astigmatism fit or not. And that means that we must have a bit more signal to noise, or it will be less accurate because we have one additional parameter than the conventional imaging. This is the result of fitting a test data set, well, actually the D3 data set in this case, where we you see the distribution of the default C. So the default switch was set in EPU was 1.5 microns, and we get actually an average of about 1.7 with a spread of 380 or so. So you see there is quite a bit of deviation. And when you are trying to collect the image close to focus, that means that you will be plus minus 150 nanometers above or below, and then the whole idea of collecting data with the faceplate in focus is kind of gone. The other issue I mentioned is that we have to change the faceplate every few hundred images, and that's because the phase shift gradually increases. This is the plot of the phase shift. You see here, in the beginning, we don't actually bother to precondition the faceplate because the first few images actually are enough to create the phase shift already on the film. So the phase shift is quite low, then it starts to increase, and after about 100 images, it passes half pi. Then here we change the faceplate, we move to a new position. Then again it increases, here we again move to a new position, and so on. So in EPU, that should be possible to be done automatically in the near future. Another issue with fitting the CTF with the faceplate is this strange deformation of the CTF, and you see it's only close to the center. This happens because the focusing, when done with the beam tilt, moves the beam and hits the faceplate film in two spots, which are not visible in this case, but in other cases, actually, they are visible on the film, which hit the film here and here, and that creates additional phase shifts on both sides, and then you get kind of an astigmatic lower portion of the CTF, while the outer portion is still kind of okay. So in this case, what I'm doing actually for the face the CTF fit is I'm fitting above certain resolution. So I cannot use the central portion of the CTF for the fit of the CTF. So what is the faceplate at the current state of things usable for in practice? Well, it could be used for quickly building a low resolution model for a new sample, or one which is not very easy, let's say, for evaluation of sample quality. So because of the high contrast and working closer to focus, you can easily judge by eye, for example, particle distribution, purity, state of assembly, orientation, etc. Now, it could be a native state, higher resolution alternative to negative stain, so kind of reduce the negative things in negative stain and maybe make the reviewers more positive about your low resolution structures and they may be accepted. And in the future, probably tackle heterogeneous, more flexible, and smaller flexible samples, which are difficult things for conventional acquisition. Now, the main issues, as I already said, is the focusing. We have to try three-image method. Probably, it would be much better if we do CTF fit after the initial beam tilt focusing, or if we can avoid it completely to prevent this elliptical deformation of the CTF in the center. Also, we have to take care, think about objective lens hysteresis. So if you approach from, say, minus 1 micron to zero, and then if you go to plus 1 micron and back to zero, you won't be at the same zero anymore. So there is some hysteresis in the objective lens. And also eye thickness. So if your window of possible or allowed focus values is plus minus 50 nanometers, then if you know your eyes is like 100 nanometers thick, you are already at the limits. The other issue is the 20% information loss, so maybe try even thinner films, although we are kind of on the practical lower limit of thickness of having a stable freestanding carbon films over wide apertures. Try graphene in the future. I already have tried it, and it shows the same volta potential evolution. The only problem is, again, getting a graphene sheet spread freestanding on a big aperture. The CTF deformation due to the focusing spots is maybe increased the tilt angle. It's already at 5 millirad, and I don't think it's very practical to go to more than 10 millirad, or if that's possible in hardware. But or another alternative is probably to use the CTF fitting. And, of course, this automation of faceplate movement exchanges or switching, which will be easily done in EPU. And these are all the people that have helped to develop the faceplate so far and contributed to data and so on. And thank you very much for your attention.